Hello, welcome back to another edition of the Telltale Heart podcast. I am so excited today about my good friend who's a guest, and we'll jump into who he is and his topic. And he's coming off of the Anticoagulation Forum meeting this weekend, which if you're not aware of who or what the Anticoagulation Forum, it is kind of the premier anticoagulation-based society, in my opinion, in the United States. They are really doing progressive cutting edge efforts around the concept of anticoagulation stewardship. They've helped establish residencies in thrombosis and hemostasis for pharmacists, really focusing on the overall complete management of the patients and the populations that are engaged all across the spectrum in anticoagulation management. And I'm so excited to tie in the concept of this based on our previous guest. If you heard our last episode, Dr. Steve Dunn talked about the acute coronary syndrome guidelines, and I gave Dr. Dunn a very strict ultimatum not to talk about left ventricular thrombus because I knew A, who I was going to bring on for this week, and knew that there was going to be a specific trial presented at the American College of Cardiology this past week or a couple weeks ago. And this ties it all together between anticoagulation stewardship, a disease state that you think about left ventricular thrombus and what we manage and how we do this. And a lot of pharmacists may not either be comfortable or not familiar with left ventricular thrombus management because we've had lots of changes in this space. Of course, we've talked about PCI management last week and how we've gotten so good at this. And what does it mean to develop a left ventricular thrombus? What type of thrombus is it? What can we do with our anticoagulation management that we have today? I mean, there are so many great questions, and unfortunately or fortunately, lots of room for opportunity to either interpret evidence or put that evidence in the context. And so that's why I'm excited about today, because we have lots of great things to talk about. So I'm not going to delay anymore to talk to my guest, esteemed colleague, Dr. Arthur Allen. Arthur, welcome to the show. And tell the audience who you are and what do you do for your career?
Hey, Craig, thanks for having me on. It's good to be here. Appreciate what you're doing in this space. So I was born a poor boy in Mississippi. Perhaps that's going back a little bit too far. I am a clinical pharmacy specialist, anticoagulation program manager at the VA hospital in Salt Lake City. I was in Reno for several years before that. I've got about 25 years in the VA and have been involved for 15 years or more in national initiatives within VA or surrounding anticoagulation thrombosis management. I also began working with the Anticoagulation Forum also about 15 years ago, give or take. I helped them develop their Centers of Excellence program. And then I eventually was their representative to the board of directors of the Thrombosis and Hemostasis Societies in North America, and then eventually a board member of the Anticoagulation Forum itself, where I'm still serving and serve as the organization's treasurer, involved in a bunch of different committees, doing a lot of work in this space. So appreciate the plug. It's a great organization, as you mentioned, multidisciplinary. So that is me in a nutshell.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've known and admired you for a long time. And just to be very clear and transparent, this will not be the last time you as an audience hear about Anticoagulation Forum. You know, we'll probably bring other people to talk about these concepts, or clearly anticoagulation is a very important domain in the cardiovascular arena. And so we'll get to hear more about them. And there's great references that you'll hear about in this episode and other things that can help you and your team practice in this space. So I really do encourage you, if you've not checked it out, become a member of Anticoagulation Forum, to really go spend some time, irrespective of where you practice. It doesn't matter if you practice in a hospital, in a clinic, in a retail community pharmacy. There is literally something there for everyone. So Arthur, I'm going to jump into this. Can you just walk people listening through just a brief overview of what is or how do we develop an LV thrombus, and why do we need to care about LV thrombi at this point? So
yeah, sure. So LV thrombus is one of a handful of potential sources of cardioembolic phenomena that can lead to stroke and systemic embolism. You know, when you have strokes, there's a whole checklist of things we go through to see where it came from or why folks had it. when we think of ischemic strokes, strokes can be broken down into thrombotic strokes, thinking of strokes that kind of formed at the area, kind of the same mechanism that happens with ACS, right? You have a plaque rupture and you have a clot that forms there. But when you have a cardioembolic source, we need to remember not only do cardioembolic forces increase the risk of stroke, they increase the risk of having a big, bad, ugly stroke that's more likely to leave you dead or disabled because of the size of the thrombus and therefore the size of the occlusion and therefore the amount of brain that can be affected. So LV thrombus is one of these things. Others might include atrial fibrillation, PFO or ASD, those kinds of things, flinging stuff off of valves. But LV thrombus occurs. Historically, we think about them occurring in the setting of acute myocardial injury. And in fact, most of the guidance historically have come from those types of LV thrombus. But more and more, where we're actually seeing these is in people with kind of chronic LV dysfunction. We go to do an echo for some other reason, and we say, well, we can look at that. There's thrombus. So it's one thing when they show up as part of either a stroke workup or as part of a kind of routine follow-up following an MI. In those settings, we're expecting clot to be fresh and organizing and anticoagulation therapy to have more likelihood of resulting in or assisting in the clearance of clot, more likely that the transient risk factor that caused that thrombus to form is going to improve, as opposed to when we find these in somebody that has a left ventricle as big as my head with hardly any movement, hypokinesis, akinesis, perhaps LV aneurysm. And we find them in their kind of chronic state. So this is kind of one of the things where I think that a lot of studies get this wrong, and a lot of the guidance can be a little bit misleading.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you and I have talked a lot about this. And for your audience listening, you may hear other terms. You may definitely see a clot. You may see signs of clot. It could be haziness, or they'll call it like a haze. And to your point, that chronic nature gets difficult because if you didn't know something was there and it had been there for a while, like calcified or whatever that may be, you're often wondering what do I do with this to this nature. And I love your call out to, not just the myocardial injury and the poor perfusion and the traditional risk factors that we think of. And not that those aren't important, but to your point, there's a lot of instances where people may have a ill-functioning or inappropriately functioning ventricle. And this is, if you think about the good old-fashioned Virchow triad and the things that put you at risk of thrombosis, these things lead to that construct. So, all right. So just give us a little bit of a walkthrough. And I think to contextualize, there was a recent, and you can allude to this, and I know you will because you and I have had lots of conversations about this. The AHA, the American Heart Association, put a statement out several years ago regarding the kind of contemporary management and thought processes around LV thrombi or thrombus. What is the current management diet paradigm for this, and what goes into thinking about the management strategies with this in terms of the disease state? So where are we at today? And that document contextualizes, here's what we used to do and here's where we're at. So just summarize for me what that document says and what we're at in contemporary management.
Right. So the AHA statement came out in 2022, and it really finally, for the first time, kind of called out what I was beginning to see as the elephant in the room of there being kind of two different, I don't want to call it mechanisms of LV thrombus, but really two kind of clinical pictures of LV thrombus. Historically, first, it's important to understand, prior to these guidelines, and if you think about if you've worked with cardiologists who treat these and kind of what their goals of therapy are and that kind of thing, we were often finding that regardless of the circumstances of an LV thrombus being formed, they were often treating them the same. They would find a clot either be it in the acute AMI setting or in the chronic setting, and their goal would be, well, we'll put them on anticoagulation therapy. We'll see if the clot goes away. If the clot went away, XYZ, if clot didn't go away, whatever. And that was, to their defense, it was in their defense, it was based on prior guidance, which was based on mostly pre-PCI their studies. And those studies back before we had PCI and we could really limit the myocardial injury associated with acute MI by revascularization, people had bigger MIs, they had more myocardial injury, more stunning of the ventricle, more likely to have these clots. And so all of those guidance was kind of based on what do we do when there's acute clot, and then what are the goals of therapy? And again, going back to what I was saying before, that when you have an acutely stunned myocardium, you have you mentioned Virchow's triad, you have vessel injury, you have injury of the myocardial wall, you have perhaps some stasis because of hypokinesis or akinesis and this stunning that can happen. Not only do you have acute clot that we can expect to treat, but we have the perfect storm that came together to cause that clot. We can expect that to get better. If we were to liken this to venous thrombosis, if I have a venous thrombosis that occurs following, say, major orthopedic surgery, we've also activated Virchow's triad, and 3 months later, we expect those risk factors to have been transient. And that's kind of what I think that we can expect in LV thrombus. The problem is much of the LV thrombus that we find, as I mentioned, is occurring more in the chronic state, more perhaps an incidental finding on echo, more likely to be, a thrombus that's laminated to the ventricle. You'd have to have a hammer and chisel to remove it. And yet, folks were expecting to have the same kind of goals of therapy. Well, I'm going to give them 3 months or 6 months of anticoagulation therapy. I'm hoping that this thing goes away. And that's just not even a realistic expectation. So to answer your question, what the 2022 guidelines did, there's a great graphic in that document that really kind of splits down a couple of different pathways. First of all, before I even get to the different pathways, they also talk about prevention and they give some good guidance on, hey, here's some settings, specifically in the setting of dilated cardiomyopathy or acute injury, where we might expect to see LV thrombus form, and whether or not it might be advisable to do something preventative in those measures. But then when we get down to the other pathways, then we really kind of split off into, hey, we have acute, those clots occurring in the acute setting, and we have those occurring in more of a dilated cardiomyopathy picture. And without going into too much detail, here's kind of the moral of the story. There are settings where we kind of might expect to have that clot go away, and improvement in function. And in those settings, even if the clot doesn't go away, but we have significant improvement in function, it may be reasonable to continue or to discontinue oral anticoagulation therapy. And on the other hand, in the other settings with dilated cardiomyopathy, where we have perhaps the clot does go away, but we still have these kind of ongoing risk factors for thrombus formation that really didn't change. The only thing that happened was the clot went away. Then we might even consider those, despite the absence of continued thrombus, we might consider long-term therapy. So it's not black and white. You mentioned the conference last week. I actually gave a lecture at AC Forum, and the lecture I was asked to give was on common mistakes. And one of the mistakes that I listed was having unrealistic expectation of anticoagulant therapy. And I think that that applies here because in the LV thrombus literature, we'll often find the goals of therapy being, well, did the clot go away? And as I've just described, there are situations where we shouldn't even necessarily have an expectation that it would, because it's perhaps been there for weeks to months to years before you even identified it. And so we need to remember that anticoagulants are not lytics. They don't dissolve blood clots. And if you look even in the literature, the individual studies, many of them, in fact, I actually used in my presentation a comical example of where we're having unrealistic expectations of anticoagulants. And it was a intracardiac thrombus study that referred to rivaroxaban lysing thrombus and clot and leading to it to a clot dissolving. We know in the venous thrombosis lecture that's not what happened. These clots get endothelialized within perhaps 30 to 45 days, certainly by 3 months. They get endothelialized, they've actually become scar. And unless you have clot flopping in the breeze, the likelihood of anticoagulant therapy, all anticoagulant therapy does is prevent it from embolizing, from extending, can help stabilize the thrombus, and then perhaps natural processes will clear the thrombus, but perhaps not. And if it doesn't, those clots become really part of the vessel wall. And so in the cardiology literature, where we're looking at LV thrombus and the goals of therapy being clot clearance and dissolving clots and lysis of clots, it's not even a realistic goal. And so we need to be careful when we read these studies to determine what the proper goal probably should be.
Oh my gosh, so much to unpack there. And I love every of this. And I know you and I have alluded to these conversations before, but I love a couple of things you said. One, the realistic goal for anticoagulation therapy piece, first and foremost, I think we often forget that sometimes anticoagulants do not take things to zero, right? That there's no trial where anticoagulants take things to complete zero, right? That's that realistic piece in the goal. And then to your point about both prevention, which is very important, and often an area when we think about preventing, LV thrombi and those things, depending on the disease state, that's a different piece of mechanism. Maybe some similar overlap concepts, but you're looking at different maybe population and process, and obviously not as well defined. And of course, we're getting better and better in the acute myocardial space, MI space, of managing those and better with stents and being more timely in revascularization. So your impact of having this downtime or ventricular stunting is in somewhat different, but it could still be there. And I think your other piece, and you and I have alluded to this, is do you think about an LV thrombus to the extent of what you're referring to as a more VTE type concept, or more of an atrial fibrillation type concept, right? Where it's like, well, we're actually trying to prevent versus, we're treating a VTE. And I think, and maybe it's comparing those veins of existence there. To your point, they're different, both important and overlapping, but different conceptually of what you're trying to do or accomplish or potentially put in that vein. And I think it is definitely something people need to think through as they're thinking about LV thrombi and the literature and what we're doing and having continual understanding for. So you've nailed just amazing points right there for that piece.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just add real quickly, Craig, that there have been studies that have tried to look at should we anticoagulate patients with low EF, right? So if you can go way back to the WATCH trial, to the WARSET trial, you can go back to the low dose DOAC trial, COMMANDER HF. And the problem with when I've had these conversations with people before is that they'll refer to those trials and say, oh, no, we shouldn't give anticoagulants for the low EF. What those studies don't necessarily narrow down to, low EF is one thing. Low EF, because the apex of the ventricle is not moving at all, or low EF because you have the septal wall is completely hypokinetic. Those are not kind of, in my opinion, those aren't apples to apples comparisons.
Correct.
And so when I would try to bring these things up before this set of guidelines to say there are ongoing risk factors for clot formation, folks would often quote those studies. But in my opinion, if you've proven that you'll form clot in the heart, and this goes right to what you're saying, is it more of an AFib picture, VTE picture? The problem is that once the cardiologist or someone sees the clot, their focus often becomes the clot.
Yeah, you
Whether we're
can't
talking
unsee the
about
clot, right?
you can't unsee it,
It's
and we see this even in VTE disease. We see people who are not specialists going, well, I've repeated the ultrasound and the clot was still there, and so we got to continue the anticoagulation therapy. Do you know that there's no guideline anywhere that says you should repeat studies in VTE disease, and
right.
certainly nothing that says that you should base your decision to anticoagulate on the presence or absence of clot? Why? Because beyond the acute phase, it's no longer about the clot, it's about the risk of having another one. And the problem is, how do we get our cardiology colleagues to think the same way in intracardiac thrombus?
Which you think is interesting because at that point you're becoming patient focused and patient risk factor focused, which is what we try to think about regularly, right? We think about risk scoring and what are the things that would put someone at a risk and how we're going to reduce the risk. And This is a total side conversation, not for today. And Arthur, you and I can have a separate conversation, and maybe in the future we'll bring it back. This is a little bit of some of the paradigm you're seeing with some of the conversations around the factor 11A inhibitors or the 11A agents that are coming out as they try to figure out the market for some of these agents. This is what they're getting towards in terms of residual risk. So, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
So just kind of to I love your explanation. And by the way, Arthur, would you alluded to the guidelines, but I think AC Forum has some resources for this type of conversation if people want to learn more in a quick digestible format. What would you refer them to from the AC
Yeah,
Forum team?
so we worked on an excellent so the AC Forum has a number of resources. They started several years ago developing kind of original content, what they call rapid resources. These are 1 to 2 page documents, which kind of walk through areas of clinical conundrum or give some clinical guidance. And we had had a prior that we had one on LV thrombus that dated back several years ago that really just kind of talked about the data, perhaps up to the Red Velvet trial. But with the 2022 AHA statement coming out, we've redeveloped that into a beautiful document that really very clearly defines that there are a couple of different pathways. There's the acute, AMI kind of historically classic LV thrombus picture, and then there's this dilated cardiomyopathy picture. So I would definitely refer folks to that. You'll see that it aligns pretty well with that 2022 AHA statement.
Yeah, and it's beautifully done. It's very quick and easy and digestible and great to use with your teams. And I have to say, Arthur and I have to caveat and be biased. We help put it together. So, but it is very helpful, and you can find it there. We'll put it in the show notes in case people are curious. So, Arthur, can you tell us, obviously we alluded to, in this conversation in the last week, Dr. Dunn, presenter 2 weeks ago, Dr. Zun gave us an overview of the ACC/AHA guidelines, and they had a specific call out to left ventricular thrombus kind of management. They did not give any specific, class recommendations per se, but just what did they say in that particular document? We're talking about 2.5 years later.
Well, right. And so there is a nice call out in there, and it does recommend, a minimum of 3 months of therapy. We don't have to commit to six like people might, believe. But again, I would caution that those guidelines were ACS guidelines, right? And so they only speak to that one type of LV thrombus that we've been talking about that date back historically to the prior guidance. But it did give nice guidance. I think that the minimum of 3 months, I think it's reasonable to re-image in there. And I believe, don't quote me, but I believe that there was reference to or I should say a lack of reference to a particular class of drugs. There are those who still believe that warfarin should be favored, and I think that those guidelines would suggest otherwise necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of a put you on the spot. I want the audience to be very clear, and you did exactly or highlighted what we want to be. This is only a small subset of population, those people post ACS that we were referring to in the one mechanism or one set of this. So it just is a reminder. These are a lot more complex topics than people want to sometimes give them credit to, and that you have to think through. But you're absolutely right, and it didn't have that particular call out that you're alluding to. But what is nice about this is quite quickly on the heels of these became the Riverwar trial that was just presented at ACC. So tell us, Arthur, what was the purpose of this trial? What was the overview? What were they trying to accomplish in this design of the study?
Yeah, so the Riverwar trial was nicely done. First of all, it was open label, but it was a randomized controlled trial of rivaroxaban versus warfarin. So as opposed to it being a retrospective review, it was a prospective trial, though open label. About 261 patients from a single center in Pakistan that experienced LVT. But again, it was LV thrombus in the setting of acute MI. So with all the caveats of the conversation we've had so far. The primary endpoint was complete dissolution of LV thrombus, and they looked at the 1 and at the 3 month mark. They looked at death, major bleeding, and stroke as secondary endpoint. And there are a couple things we can take from this. Riva was started at 20 milligrams a day. One of the most common questions that I get is what dose, since this is off-label and we don't know a dosing strategy, what's the proper dosing strategy for LV thrombus? And to my knowledge, we have not had a kind of a prospective determinant of what that should be. Should it be a, especially in the setting of acute thrombus like this, should it be, a VTE dosing where we use a higher intensity up front? The other interesting thing is in the warfarin arm, as best as I can tell, there was actually not crossover with parenteral, which is especially interesting and perhaps concerning in patients who had acute VTE. And I do kind of wonder if that led to some of the early results. But that's the study design. So again, acute MI, LV thrombus in setting of acute MI, prospective rivaroxaban versus warfarin, utilizing what I would call an AFib dosing because they started with rivaroxaban 20 daily compared to warfarin, but it was open label.
Yeah, and it just nicely nuances some of the other pieces of this conversation that we just talked about. It's not just what is the mechanism and what are we trying to treat, and even to the goals of therapy, but to your point, like you alluded to the dose, I think these are always the questions, depending on what you think the mechanism is or what we're trying to accomplish, really depends on what we think we're going to do, how the dosing strategy should be, and the debate of should you do a lead, the traditional VT higher dose phase and then switch them over, or do we start with just the AFib phase? And to your point, yes, I absolutely agree with you on the concern about did they not start anything acutely for the competitor phase, and does that change what the results could have been? But you're absolutely right. It has been prospective. We have had lots of retrospective trial design. It's clearly, unfortunately, something that we need more data on. I don't think we're ever really maybe going to get some. We can talk about that here at the end. But tell us, what did the results of this trial come bore out?
Right. So at the 1 month mark, in the rivaroxaban arm, there were 20% or so of patients that had cleared their thrombus compared to only 8.3% of warfarin. So again, I wonder if that could be related to the lack of a parenteral crossover. This,
Right.
remember, we don't have the paper, so we don't know the details, how well is the
Sure.
warfarin controlled. We don't, there's some stuff we don't know. We only have the high level reporting. But at 3 months, it was really the same. 95.8 versus 96.6% Riva versus warfarin had complete thrombus resolution, and the secondary endpoints were comparable across the groups.
Yep. And then no really increased risk of harm that we saw between the groups. So, it appears to be safe and somewhat effective. Of course, it goes to all the things we just talked about, right? I mean, there is lots of caveats and things to that. So tell me, what does this mean for you or for your team, or as you approach these patients in your practice, and as you put this with the rest of the data and items we just talked about, how are you? Are you thinking differently about this? Are you like, yeah, I feel even more confident about direct acting agents? Where are you at in your paradigm based on this data and other data? And of course, go ahead.
I was pretty much always okay with DOACs for LV thrombus. But this is my mantra within the last 15 years of DOACs has been, just because something is off label for a DOAC doesn't mean it's on label for warfarin. And if we were only making things up with warfarin because it's the only drug we had, if we're going to make stuff up anyway, who cares what you use? At
Right.
least that's what I was saying until Red Velvet. And the problem is that many folks know Red Velvet. They've quoted Red Velvet, and there are some cardiologists who are hung on like a snapping turtle that you have to use a VKA for these agents, despite multiple papers, all of which limited in some way, much like Red Velvet was, to suggest that DOACs are fine. But here's so. High level, what does Revor do for us? Well, it further supports use of DOAC for LVT. It does so in a prospective manner. It shows better clot clearance at the 1 month mark. And I think that we can finally put this issue to bed about DOAC versus warfarin, in my opinion. It also gives more clarity on the dosing strategy, as I mentioned, because people have wondered which dosing strategy to use. I do wonder about the lead-in issue with Wolfram. At the end of the day, we ended up with clot clearance. My overall question about these types of studies in general is, are we looking at the wrong outcome? Why was red velvet so important? Red velvet was important because it looked at thromboembolic complications rather than clot clearance.
Sure.
And while in an acute MI study like this one, I do think that looking at clot clearance with secondary endpoints of thromboembolic and bleeding complications is fine. I think overall, when we go to evaluate the literature on this and we say, can we use a DOAC or not, more often than not, what you're finding is clot clearance, clot clearance, clot clearance, regardless of the age of the thrombus. And it is a flaw, not only in the study, but in the understanding, in my opinion, of the people who are doing the study. And so I think that more important to thrombus resolution is thromboembolic complications, and especially for those kind of chronic, those chronic LVTs that are associated with ongoing wall motion abnormalities and that kind of thing. I think that should be our goal and not clot clearance, because again, clot clearance in that setting is often. One thing I would challenge, here's what I'll challenge the audience. If you want to go back and look at all of these retrospective studies, meta-analyses, what have you on LV thrombus, including those that say, well, the patient was on a DOAC and they didn't clear their clot, so we switched them to revert to warfarin and blah, blah, blah. And back, or they were on warfarin and we switched them to a DOAC. There are all these studies out there. Here's what I'll challenge you with. Look at the overall clot clearance rate in those. I was just looking at one, a French study, from I think 2021, and they did all of these manipulations and reported on this didn't clear it, so we put them on that. Guess what? Just over half of the clot cleared at all, despite no matter what you did. And so that is my point, is understanding the goals of therapy and having realistic expectations of anticoagulant therapy.
It such a beautiful message, and I really think we have so much more to do, and maybe still opportunity to work through these things, given that we have a next round of therapeutic agents coming out for anticoagulation management, but further, improve somewhat safety profiles and to that same point. But it's absolutely fine-tuning and nailing the goals and understanding what these are. But I agree with you on the statement, and just for clarity's sake, when you say, the 20 milligram of rivaroxaban, you would equate that to the equivocal AFib starting dose for other direct acting agents, correct?
I wouldn't
Yeah.
necessarily make, this is the other problem, is people get dogmatic and
Yeah.
they say, well, we have to use rivaroxaban because that's what was used in the study. Guys, this is 261 patients at one center in Pakistan. I would be fine with assuming a class effect. Again, because I don't have the paper, I don't
Right.
know if they dose reduced. I don't know if they were truly following AFib versus VTE without a lead-in
Sure.
regimen, because I don't know what they did in renally impaired patients, yada yada. But and my stance has primarily historically been using an AFib dosing approach, unless perhaps there's literally a pedunculated clot flopping in the breeze. But even then, I think that this study probably gives us permission to do it even in that setting, where we know that, because again, these were LV thrombus setting of acute MI. We know these were fresh, acute thromboses, and we got away with just the 20 milligram dose.
Awesome. Well, my last kind of clinical question for you, and I know this falls into the alignment of AC forum and even anticoagulation stewardship. How should for pharmacists be engaged in the management of these patients, and how why should we be proactive in this, and what is can the pharmacist be of value in this?
Yeah, so I think that pharmacists are in the best position to actually have realistic expectation of anticoagulants. And so my role in this has been trying to remind our cardiology colleagues, especially those with gray hair or no hair like me, that there is new thinking with this, that the old guidelines were based on acute clot. When we're finding these more commonly in as incidental findings or in patients with a dilated cardiomyopathy, really trying to get them to think about them differently, really having them trying to get them to have appropriate goals and questioning if clot clearance is really the right goal. So trying to separate thinking on these. That has been kind of my main thing, is making them aware, that we may be thinking about these incorrectly in certain settings, and reminding them that anticoagulants are not lytics. And even if they were, a clot that's 3, 6, 12 months old can't even be lysed.
It's all about, you remember, they're not classified that way, right? Yeah, absolutely. I just so much richness into your comments and things for people to think through. I will tell you, this has been phenomenal. I always love having conversations with Arthur Allen about anticoagulation. I think we both love this space. I tell you what, if you guys like more conversations like this, definitely check out the AC Forum. The group of pharmacists that are doing this work are, and the team. There's a whole team, but definitely the pharmacists that are working. It is a great group, and really you can get to the micro level on these things. So, Arthur, we always ask non-clinical questions, or at least one non-clinical question to show people that we're, kind of the humanistic side. But if you had to tell me what is one thing you've mostly read or watched or listened to or now, or even your favorite thing, what would you suggest or recommend to the readers or the listeners, excuse me?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess my textbook answer is just so I don't look like a lazy bum that sits around watching Netflix as much as I do. I was going to suggest the AC Forum webinars, literature reviews, and the rapid recaps from the AC Forum. As far as non-clinical, I've been actually trying to go back and read a little bit of C.S. Lewis, which I kind of
Oh,
never
yeah.
did. But going back a
Great.
little bit, C.S. Lewis, and then pretty much any. I can easily be sucked into watching entirely too much television. So I
Yeah.
will
Well, there's a
admit
lot
that.
of good things. Apparently,
Yeah.
having talked to a lot of pharmacists since I started this podcast and doing it, a lot of people are watching Severance. I apparently need to watch this show.
I apparently need to get Apple TV again to watch Severance. I keep hearing about it
Yeah.
as well.
But at C.S. Lewis is great. Our kids are starting to venture down some efforts for C.S. Lewis. So I very much appreciate that piece. Very good. And then Arthur, just this has been amazing. I appreciate you being flexible and being with us today and taking time out of your day. I know you're coming straight off of AC Forum, which is a jam-packed, robust time. However, and we'll tag you in our post, but if people wanted to find you on social media, where could they find you?
Well, I've historically not done a lot on social media, but you can find me on X at A. Allen PharmD. I'm also under Arthur Allen at LinkedIn.
Very good. And you'll see him publishing papers and doing good work. And he is just awesome. So I've loved and honored to always know him and mentor him. And I look up to Arthur a ton. So I appreciate you being on the show today. So,
The feeling is mutual. Appreciate it, Craig.
yep. So thank you, Pharmacy Times, again, for helping us produce these episodes, and the team that is behind this. They know who they are. I appreciate them and their support for this effort. We appreciate all of our listeners and everybody joining us today, and hope you've gotten a more and better appreciation of LV thrombus management and the things to think through. And be on the lookout for our next episode, when we're going to talk a little bit about cardiokidney metabolic and pharmacists who are doing great work there. I appreciate everyone's time, and please join us next time, won't you?